Thank you for joining us today for the KRFY Morning Show here on 88.5 FM. I'm Phil Huff, and along with co-host
Julie Calamine. Good morning, Phil.
We welcome you, and a good morning to all. In the studio today, we will be talking with three guests from the Yellowstone's Yukon Initiative, also known, and we'll use the shorthand, Y2Y. We have with us Kim Trotter, the U.S. Program Director, Candace Batiki, the Program Director from British Columbia, and Wendy Francis, a former Program Director and now a consultant with the Y2Y. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Phil. Yeah.
So let's just launch in right with the big picture stuff, Wendy. You've been working with the Y2Y group for a long time now. Describe the Y2Y region and why it's important.
The Yellowstone to Yukon region stretches from the southern end of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. So think of the Wind River Mountain Range all the way north up the mountain chain to almost to the Yukon to the Arctic Circle in the Yukon. And it's a very mountainous region. It's one of the most intact mountain regions in the world. And that's why it is the subject of the focus of our work. It has all the large mammal populations that existed when North America was discovered by the Europeans. And there's much here that's been lost in most of the rest of the world. And so we have this tremendous opportunity in the Yellowstone-Yukon region to have thriving wildlife populations, incredible scenic vistas, opportunities for people to recreate and to have thriving communities. And that's the vision of the Yellowstone to Yukon Initiative.
So how did the initiative get involved with its work in preserving the landscape?
It really evolved from the conservation work of the 1960s and 70s, which focused on either protecting particular species or particular places, but we realized that wasn't enough to prevent some of the endangered species, the mortalities to wildlife that was happening. And we came to understand that it wasn't just about protecting species in one place, about creating a park and then saying, there, the job is done, we've protected that population of bears or wolves or elk or whatever it is. We began to understand that these animals roam over very, very large distances. And in order to ensure their future, we need to protect that ability to move across the landscape. And that's really what made the Y2Y initiative different when it started out, is it was really focused on not only protecting habitat, but also protecting this ability for wildlife to move through habitat, that the same habitat that people are using for resource extraction and places to live. So it's where wildlife and people come together, that's the intersection where Y2Y works.
And so one might say it's really about connectivity across the landscape, room to roam for animals, but connectivity too with the human population and the landscape.
That's absolutely right. It's about both. It's our mission statement is about protecting and connecting habitat so that people and wildlife can thrive. It's, as I say, it's about both of us sharing the landscape together.
And it's a big landscape. There's this imaginary line that runs east to west, a border, if you will, between Canada and the U.S. And that's a fiction, really, of our own creation. The animals don't know that border, do they?
They don't. And that's been one of the significant emphasis of the Yellowstone to Yukon Initiative is to look at that transboundary region and make sure that we can keep wildlife connected between Canada and the U.S., especially in the U.S. where you have some very endangered populations of large animals like grizzly bears, whereas in Canada we have a pretty significant reservoir of grizzly bears. So the future of the U.S. grizzly bear population depends on keeping them connected across that border.
So that's a grand vision. Tell us a little bit about how the vision works across two different countries, how the Canadian portion, if you will, works with the U.S. portion, how that vision came about.
It started in Canada. The first meeting was held in Alberta in 1993, but it was the first time that Canadian and American conservationists came together and started talking about how they could work together at this grand scale. And the Yellowstone to Yukon organization has staff in Canada and staff in the U.S., and they plan their work across that boundary and in an integrated way.
It sounds very cooperative, But let's just jump right into this. A lot of people look at international cooperation with some fear. And there are folks that we've heard of who look at the wide why as if it were some kind of grandiose conspiracy theory. And while that, from the work that you've done, is something that, I've not seen, it comes up from time to time. How would you address that?
I'll take that one, Phil. So that is something that we hear. We hear associations with Agenda 21 or with some kind of UN plot. And people can, you know, often believe what they want to believe, but frankly, there's no truth to that. I like to joke about it because if that were the truth, it would give me great power. But I'm a staff of one in the United States. As the U.S. program director, I am the sole staff at this point. And to give you just a little bit of background, you know, I'm a native Idahoan, and this is a place where I've hunted and fished and my whole life with my parents who raised me here, and it's where I've chosen to raise my children. So I see myself as someone who spent her entire life protecting areas by working with land trusts and hunting and angling groups. And the Why Do I mission fits right in with that. We need to work with other partners, and we need to work with agencies and landowners alike to really protect what we all live here for. We all live here because we love the natural resources of Idaho.
So it's a cooperative approach. It sounds like it involves a lot of different partners and organizations and different levels of authorities.
Very much so. Why Do I has over 350 partners throughout the U.S. and Canada. And those partners range from small watershed groups all the way up to national groups working on land protection and water quality. We also are working very closely with both agencies and in both the U.S. and Canada with Native American tribes and First Nations. And we really value those partnerships. We realize that with a vision as ambitious as the Why Do I vision, we need to work with all levels of people on private and public lands to truly connect this landscape.
So this isn't really a land grab. Why Do I is not trying to take control of all of these lands. It's more of an implementation of the vision?
Well, first of all, Why Do I doesn't, we're not a land trust. We don't acquire land at all. So at least Why Do I is not part of that at all. But I'd also argue that it's just opposite of that. And public lands right now are open for all of us to use. We have access, and these are the lands that we fish on, that we hunt on, that we get our timber from. They're the lands that we fill our freezers from. And our public lands are very important to us. And right now, our public lands are under threat from a private land takeover, and or a state land takeover. So I would argue just opposite, that the threat is not the government takeover of our public lands, but instead that these are lands that we all need to protect and make sure that we're good stewards of.
So tell us a little bit more about how Why Do I implements that vision, the approach that your work does take.
Sure. So we work in a number of venues, but I would say that it can be summarized into kind of the three C's. We're working on connectivity issues, we're working on conservation, and we're working on coexistence. And so when we're talking about conservation, we're working to protect core areas that are important for habitat or important for wildlife by protecting habitat that is essential for animals to live in. We're also working on connectivity. We need to make sure that animals can move back and forth to other core areas in linkage zones. And one of the ways that we're working here is working on transportation. So we're working really closely with departments of transportation in our region to make sure that highways and roads, one of the major fragmenters of our habitat, to get wildlife across roads. And then we're working on coexistence. How do we as humans interact with wildlife and build a social tolerance for wildlife in our areas?
Mm-hmm. So you're not trying to shuttle bus the grizzly bears from Yellowstone up to the Yukon. You're trying to work on how they cross the roads.
How do they cross the roads? But also, how do we work with people to allow them to live in certain areas? How do we reduce human conflicts? We're working with a number of partners to really educate people in grizzly bear country and grizzly country to store their trash in ways that and to fence chicken coops to make sure that they're not attracting grizzly bears directly to their front doors.
Candace, I've noticed that driving north into Canada, I see the wildlife corridors. I think those have been designed for the purpose of grizzly bear movement, maybe the elk, the other species. Why 2i has a large focus on grizzly bears? Why is that?
Wendy touched on this earlier. Grizzly bears are, they focus somewhat as an umbrella species. They're a wide-ranging species with a broad range of habitat needs. So they function in that sense. We feel like if we're protecting habitat for grizzly bears so that grizzly populations are healthy and interconnected so that the bears can move across the landscape, here's this emerging theme here of connectivity, then the landscape is probably fairly healthy. Grizzly bears are not going to capture every landscape value, but they'll capture quite a few of them. But as we heard earlier, grizzly populations are also becoming fragmented. And it's very, very important that we keep the source populations in Canada and in Yellowstone, I believe now, connected to some of those areas that have few grizzly bears or no grizzly bears now, so that eventually we can see one big interconnected population of grizzly bears that's genetically connected and roaming across the mountains.
And are those tunnels that I see under the highway as I travel toward Banff, are those for grizzly bears or are those for other species?
Are you talking about the wildlife overpasses on Highway 1?
Yeah.
They are for any species that will use them. They are used by elk, they're used by wolves, they're used by bears, they're used by foxes, they're used by... I saw an amazing thing where actually people who were driving on Highway 1 were pulling over because there was a wolf pack taking down an elk on one of the overpasses. Quite an amazing thing for those people to witness. So yes, and wildlife overpasses like that are something that we're probably going to need to build more of on all our highways. They're expensive. We hope that over time they will become less expensive, but they are proving to be a part of the solution in terms of mitigating highway safety for humans and for wildlife.
So if you're just tuning in, this is the KRFY Morning Show at 88.5, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. Today, our guests are from the Yellowstone to Yukon Initiative. With us are Kim Trotter, the U.S. Program Director, Candace Batiki, the Program Director from British Columbia, and Wendy Francis, longtime Program Director from Canada and now a consultant with the Y2Y. We're covering a lot of territory today, and we've talked about a lot of exciting programs. For people who might have missed a few things or are just tuning in, where can they go to for more information?
That would be our website, Y2Y, so letter number letter, .net, N-E-T. Lots of information there.
Y2Y.net. So the Yellowstone-Yukon region is a large one. I have a lot of friends who are long-distance hikers, and a few have even tackled the northern part of the Great Divide Trail, or the Continental Divide Trail and the Great Divide Trail. It's a big stretch of land. How do you break that down? Are there sub-regions?
There are. And it's nice that you refer to that, to the Grand Hike. One of the things that happened early in the Y2Y journey was a fellow named Karsten Hewer actually hiked the entire thing and did a book and probably a video. And that was really in the early days of trying to really conceptualize what it meant to work at this incredibly large scale. So that's something that folks can look up if they're interested. But it is huge, and you can't do everything everywhere, much as we would like to, and so we have broken it down into 14-ish subregions, and we are in one of those subregions, or what we call priority areas, and we are in the Cabinet-Purcell Mountain Corridor. It's one of the transboundary priority areas, along with the Crown of the Continent ecosystem to our east, and then Kim's areas, of course, down below here in the Salmon Selway and the High Divide, and she's nodding, and I'm hoping
the
greater Yellowstone ecosystem. Thank you. And as we move north into my territory, we have the Cabinet-Purcell Mountain Corridor, we have the Central Rocky Mountain Parks, we have the Peace River Break, which is a very interesting area. It's the place where Yellowstone to Yukon as a region becomes the narrowest. It's also a very highly impacted landscape at this point, so we are working hard in that region to keep the connectivity there. It's perhaps the most vulnerable east-west spot in the Yellowstone to Yukon region. And then as we move north from there, we move into some of the great northern landscapes into the Musquecachica and the Liard River, the Skeena Nastikeen, which folks may have heard in terms of the Sacred Headwaters campaigns that that were going on a few years ago. So, you know, we talk about a lot of more emphasis on restoring in the southern areas and keeping that connectivity happening. When we get up into those really big northern areas, there's some incredible opportunities for really large landscape level protection. And then, of course, it's Yellowstone to Yukon. So it goes up into Yukon and parts of the Northwest Territories, what we call the Greater Mackenzie Mountains ecosystem or greater region. And so lots of interesting opportunities up there in the Yukon. We were quite active for many years supporting the groups on the ground who've been, and the First Nations, who've been working to protect the Peel watershed, which is a massive watershed up in the Peel River, or up in the Yukon. So yeah, here, of course, we're Cabinet Purcell Mountain Corridor, so mountains are the theme. You know, we're focused on the Rockies, but also the Purcells, the Cabinets, and the Selkirks on the BC side. So
for our listeners who live in North Idaho, and a few might be in Western Montana hearing us now, they know the Cabinet Mountains and might the Purcells, but when we talk about the region that Y2Y is interested in there, can you draw a line on a visual map for our radio listeners of where that is and a little bit more about why it's an important part of the Y2Y work?
Yep. So I'll draw the BC side because that's the side that I'm most familiar with, and I can see it on a map, and that would go down into the trench between the Purcells and Rockies, so the East Kootenai or Rocky Mountain Trench, and kind of follow the Columbia River all the way up to where, just south of Prince George there, where it bends. It's kind of the Columbias in a way, and then that would include the Columbia River coming down on the other side, west of Nelson and those areas there. So it's kind of encompassed within the bounds of the Columbia River in the north. Mm-hmm. In the south, it goes down as far as Kalispell and Highway 2. I'm going to hand this over to Kim.
Sure. So on the east side, if you take it from the trench, then it goes over to Kalispell, and to the east, it's it borders the Crown of the Continent ecosystem and or priority area. And from there, it goes all the way down to Missoula, Montana, back to the west, and follows up the Clark Fork and takes in the Cabinets and the Selkirks. So it takes in northwest Montana and the Panhandle of Idaho and a portion of eastern Washington.
So why is that area important? Why is this area important?
Oh,
we think it's important living here, but for everybody else, explain why it's important.
It's such an important area. So the area takes on about 43,750 square miles. It's a big area, but it's one of two transboundary grizzly bear populations. And so we've got the Cabinet Yak population, and the other population is the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem population out of Glacier National Park. So we only have two grizzly bear populations that are transboundary. So this is one area where, as Wendy said earlier, Canada is a reservoir for grizzly bears, and this is a way for grizzlies to get into the area. One of the areas in the U.S. that's been identified as a core habitat area that is not occupied is actually the salmon Selway Bitterroot. And if U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service achieves their goal of getting grizzly bears into the salmon Selway, they will most likely come from the Cabinet Purcell. And so this is an area where we really are working hard to ensure that grizzly bears can thrive in the Cabinet Purcell Mountain Corridor to be able to help occupy that habitat. This is an area, when you look at it from an ecosystem perspective, it's a very diverse area. We've got rolling meadows, we have arid forests, but we also have inland rainforests. And so we also, and with that as well, we've got headwaters to many of our salmon, for salmon and trout streams. And the Cabinet Purcell in these high mountain corridors are also the headwaters that provide a lot of the drinking water for many communities in both British Columbia, Idaho, and Montana, and Washington. And so these are really important areas that are worth protecting, not just from a wildlife standpoint, but also from a fisheries standpoint and from a human standpoint. really, you look at the area and see how it borders the Salmon Cellway, the Crown of the Continent, and the Northern Rockies. It's a very diverse area.
So there's a lot of, it's a large area, and there's a lot of work and a lot of projects. How are you coordinating the programs on the U.S. side of the border and the Canadian side of the border? Again, the animals don't recognize that boundary. How are you working together? How is Y2Y addressing that?
Well, this workshop this week is really the best example of that, where we work with agencies and scientists on both sides of the border to recognize where grizzly bears are moving, where they're not moving, you know, where we're having pinch points or fracture zones for bears and for other wildlife. I think we're talking a lot about grizzlies, but which is appropriate, but lots of other wildlife as well. So that's one example. Is definitely, you know, we'll be hearing for the next couple of days from people involved with the Transborder Grizzly Project, as well as others. So that's an important part of it. It's different on both sides of the border. I've worked in a transboundary kind of context all my life, and it is different. But mountain caribou is something I've worked on a lot. We have a transboundary mountain caribou herd that's shared with the U.S. So while the lands are different in terms of their ownership, the same issues apply to the species who, as you say, don't recognize those borders. So keeping our ecosystems intact is always the goal. How we do that might differ a little bit from a human perspective, but it's going to be the same on the ground.
So tell us a little bit more about some of the specific projects that are going on in the Cabinet Purcells Mountain area.
In the U.S., we're working with a number of organizations, specifically in the Cabinet Yak in northwest Montana. And we're really excited to have secured another grant through the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation through their Great Migrations and Crucial Corridors program. Y2Y acts as the facilitator or the administrator for a series of grants where we re-grant to other organizations. So we're working closely with organizations like the Yak Valley Forest Council, where they are using funds to do research on huckleberry plots. What kind of restoration is necessary on logged or on timberlands to see what gets the best huckleberry regeneration? And so doing research like this helps us so we know that although there is a, you know, this landscape is being used by humans, we're also doing a good job of restoring it so it can also be used by wildlife. We're also working on doing road recontouring. And so Y2Y has worked closely with the Kootenai National Forest and with groups like the Yak Valley Forest Council and Inroads Consulting to do recontouring of roads to fully restore roads that were previously closed by the Forest Service, so they provide good habitat for wildlife species.
Boy, it seems like there are so many agencies involved in making progress on Y2Y, but is there one agency or more than one agency that is really key to adding acres and miles to the Y2Y connectivity?
There are so many organizations and agencies that we work with. We work extremely closely with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, with groups like Fish and Game and the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. But another agency that we hope to work more closely with are the transportation departments. So right now, Y2Y is developing a coalition of sorts, or partnership with a number of organizations throughout Idaho to create a group called the Idahoans for Safe Wildlife Passage. And what we hope to do is work closely with the Department of Transportation and Department of Fish and Game to really advocate for safe wildlife crossings. And there's already a group that we're a part of in Montana called Montanans for Safe Wildlife Passage. And these groups are it's not a nonprofit or anything, but it's, you know, it's just a coalition of groups who are working on similar issues where we can work with the departments of transportation to advocate for safe wildlife passage.
I remember looking at a map of the original areas included in Y2Y and over the years that it's been increasing. How is the progress? Are you making good progress at this time? How close are you getting?
Yes, that's a great question. We actually celebrated WideAway's 20th anniversary in 2014. So the founding meeting was in December of 1993. And in 2014, we stood back and made an assessment of how we've been doing. And to do that, we created a set of two maps. And the maps compared the amount of land that was protected in the Yellowstone to Yukon region in 1993 with the amount of land that was protected in 2014. And by protected, we're meaning legally protected under either state or federal or provincial law. So parks, wilderness areas, those sorts of things. And the amount of land had almost doubled in the 20 years of WideAway's existence. So it's now something in the high teen percents, like 18-19% of the region is in some form of protection, legal protection. And then we also looked at other ways that land in the region is being managed to indicate that we're placing a value on protecting wildlife. So this would be things like private conservation easements or wildlife management areas or wilderness study areas, things that aren't permanent legal protection but indicate that we've, as I say, placed a priority on managing wildlife on these lands. And those lands had grown enormously over the 20 years of the Yellowstone to Yukon history. So we have these two maps that are showing we are actually moving towards creating this interconnected landscape through protected lands and other lands where there is a focus on conserving wildlife.
So just to be clear, going back to something you just said about the amount of protected lands and doubling, it's not that those lands have been acquired by those agencies. They've always been managed by, for instance, the federal government manages a lot of lands in our region through the Forest Service. It's the way they manage them. It's the management options they're exercising for them.
That's correct. The ownership has not changed. These lands have always been publicly owned lands, but the management has changed where there is now a focus on protecting them for the future and for future generations.
Thank you. So a lot of the work that WideAway does is in conjunction with various partner groups. We've mentioned that a couple times. Tell us a little bit about how WideAway works with those partner groups.
So earlier, Candace talked about a meeting that is being hosted in Sandpoint this week, and we're bringing together more than 25 nonprofits, a number of First Nations and tribes, and agencies and researchers to talk about connectivity, protection, and wildlife conservation in the Cabinet-Bruxelles Mountain Corridor. And that's an example of how we bring people together. And that's something mm-hmm. that I think we at WideAway really pride ourselves on is being able to bring people together to bring their part of the picture into focus. I imagine WideAway kind of like a puzzle, and every single group has their piece of the puzzle. And what we can hope to do is bring the puzzle together so everyone understands that they're part of the puzzle, whether it's land conservation or wildlife research or advocating for good forest plans, all play a part in a much bigger picture. So we're that convener often, and we're proud that we can do that in many places. But we also do on-the-ground conservation. As I talked earlier, we mentioned doing some road reclamation and road restoration. And then we also work to re-grant funding. WideAway gets funds where we can, we actually have our own grant cycle, and we can refund or re-grant to organizations throughout the U.S. and Canada. And so we realize that WideAway is a small organization, but that through the work of other organizations, we're trying to bring all of those puzzle pieces together, and that without the partner groups, that puzzle wouldn't come together very well.
So put a face on it for us. The meeting you've referred to here in Sandpoint, and by the way, by the time listeners are hearing this, the meeting
it's
will
over.
Have been past history.
And this a fantastic a, success
yeah,
it was.
A recorded show, but we hope it'll be a great success. And as I understand, there's going to be quite a large turnout, and without necessarily having to name every group that's going to be there, put a face on it for our listeners. Tell us about some of the organizations, agencies, representatives that will be at the meeting.
Sure. We have a very diverse group that's showing up this week. We have First Nations and tribes that will be coming. We have put together a series of panels on everything from transportation to helping our NGO partners with funding to grizzly bears and caribou and also talking about connectivity, science and what tools are out there to make sure that we're mapping and prioritizing the right areas for connectivity. So we have agencies coming. We have Fish and Wildlife Service. We've got Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. We have transportation departments. We have local groups. We've got land trusts. We've got trail groups. We've got watershed councils or watershed groups showing up. So it's a really it's a great way to bring many, many groups together to let them know what's happening in their region and to really highlight the work that individual groups are doing.
And so having the rare opportunity to ask this question of a funder, what are your objectives for this week, this week's meeting?
Sure. Well, our first objective is to celebrate that we've been working in the Cabinet Purcell Mountain Corridor for 10 years. 10 years ago this year, we got together with a number of our partners, including bear biologists and wildlife biologists and different groups and agencies, and created what was called the Collaborative Conservation Plan or Framework, excuse me. And this framework really laid out what are the top priorities to protect connectivity in the Cabinet Purcell Mountain Corridor. This plan has been in place for 10 years, and we've seen great success. And, you know, it's not YDWI's success, it's the conservation community's success and agency success. So, for instance, in the Cabinet Yak, if you looked at the population in the 90s, if you looked at the grizzly bear population in the 90s, it was less than 10 bears. That population is now between 48 and 50 bears. And so we see that as success, but also seeing that on a per bear basis, we're actually having fewer conflicts, human bear conflicts. So we're here to celebrate that. We're also here to share information, and we've brought together amazing experts. We've got some of the area's best experts in many, many fields who are coming to talk to our group today, talk to our group this week. And then finally, we're looking at this as adaptive management, and we've left a lot of time open so we can really discuss, are we on the right path? In 10 years, what's changed demographically? What's changed with wildlife? What's changed with climate? And so we're looking to make sure that we're on track.
And over these last 10 years, we have had a lot of discussion about climate change. And why is that important for this meeting?
I'll take that question, Julie. I mean, obviously, climate change is a serious concern for everyone. In terms of wildlife and wildlife conservation, it's really going to exacerbate the challenges that wildlife already are facing. And the major challenges have to do with losing their habitat because land is being converted for other uses, whether that's resource extraction or subdivision and settlement of the land to transportation corridors. All of these things, while very necessary for people, take habitat away from wildlife. And as we've been talking about, wildlife is also challenged already by fragmentation of their habitat, meaning it's very difficult for them to move from one patch of habitat that they need for food and security to another. Climate change is going to make this much worse because it will break up habitat even more. It's going to change the dynamics that are occurring. What's mostly going to change actually is vegetation. So as the climate becomes warmer or wetter, depending on where we're talking about, the plants that grow there now are going to not be able to grow there in the future, and new plants are going to move in. And so we're going to see a disconnection between communities of vegetation that used to have evolved together over millions of years. And wildlife are going to need to be able to find new places to meet their needs and to find the foods that they've adapted to. And they are going to need to be able to move across the landscape even more in order to adapt to climate change than has been the case just trying to deal with fragmentation. So it's just an added challenge that's going to make the job of keeping wildlife connected even more difficult in the future.
So science seems to be really underpinning a lot of the initiatives that WideWi has taken. Obviously, the client assignments that you've just talked about. What are some of the other scientific efforts or study efforts or bases for the work you do?
There's actually, I mean, we are a science-informed organization, and over the years, WideWi has commissioned many different scientific studies. So everything from where grizzly bear populations are threatened to where the areas of high collisions between vehicles and wildlife are to where high priority linkage zones are, meaning linkage zone is another word for wildlife corridor. Over the years, we've done a very comprehensive climate change report on the future of climate and its impacts in the Yellowstone-Tucson region. So we do try to make sure that all of our work is informed by the most recent science and that when we're setting priorities and when we're making public statements that those are informed by accurate scientific information.
So if somebody's listening and they want to personally get involved beyond just going to the website and finding out about more information, what can they do to help?
The first thing that I would suggest is find the group that you love the most on the ground and work locally. And I'll point to someone in the room, to Phil with Friends of Scotchman Peaks Wilderness. There are a million ways that people can volunteer to make a difference in their own community. And again, if people are making a difference, then they're being at the local level, then they're making a difference at the regional level as well. From that, you can also contact us. I have a number of projects that people could help with in the United States. And we're looking to expand our staff as well. And we're just starting to interview for a Cabinet Purcell Mountain Corridor project coordinator. And so we hope to have more projects regionally where people could help participate as well.
And again, that information is available at whitewide.net.
Yep, and all of our contact information is there as well.
Well, this has been a wonderful opportunity to learn more. We've got just a few minutes left. Do you have some closing thoughts or ideas that you'd like to share with us?
One thought that comes to mind, and I know that this is going to be a dated show, but we, through our staff and through our consultants, we've been actively working with a producer by the name of James Brundage, who with First Light Films. And this week, we're going to see the premiere on Nova of a movie called Wild Ways, Corridors of Life. And it highlights both the WideWi region and also migration corridors in Africa. And if you want to better understand the importance of wildlife corridors, this is an excellent movie that demonstrates the importance of keeping corridors connected. And you can find that on PBS or Nova.
And really, it's about connectivity because these questions matter even beyond the WideWi region to the north, south, east, west. It's all part of a larger puzzle.
Definitely.
Wendy, do you have some closing ideas? You've been working on this a long time. I'm sure you do.
Well, I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to talk about our work. I think Yellowstone to Yukon was an idea that was really ahead of its time 20 years ago. But what we've seen is that because of climate change, because of the success of things like the Banff Wildlife Overpasses, because of the increasing love that people have for nature and for getting out in nature, that WideWi really was the right idea, and it continues to be the right idea as we move forward. And when we convened that first meeting in 1993, we gave ourselves 100 years to complete the vision of protecting and connecting the Yellowstone-Tucson landscape for wildlife and for people. And so there's still lots of work to do, and we've got another 80 years to go.
And Candace here, I just wanted to say, slightly change tone and say that one of my pieces of background is that I served as a city councilor in the city of Nelson for one term, and which was a wonderful opportunity. And I wanted to kind of give a shout out to Sandpoint as one of our sister cities.
Sister city. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was something that happened during my tenure as a city councilor. And it's really great to be in Sandpoint, and I'm looking forward to spending a few days here. And it is important, you know, just sort of going back to the partnerships. You know, we talked about agencies and we talked about conservation organizations of all different stripes and tribes and First Nations, but local governments have an important role to play in many of these, many of the challenges and opportunities faced by wildlife and people in our mountain communities. And that's everything from, you know, managing how we do our developments to landowner education. There's lots of different ways that local governments have a really, really important role in planning. And I do have a little bit of history wearing that hat as well. So local governments are an important partner for us too.
Thank you. Well, on behalf of the morning show team, Julie and I would like to thank our guests from the Yellowstone to Yukon Initiative who are here in the studio with us today, Kim Trotter, Candace Batiki, and Wendy Francis. This is KRFY 88.5, Community Radio for North Idaho.